Time and Eternity. A Biblical Study, Chapter 13, by G.T. Stevenson. Whence Eternity? In 1935, the late Alexander the Mason of Edinburgh published a series of articles in which he traced the process by which words derived from Latin came to be commonly employed in translating the Greek scriptures into English. His outline and argument are so convincing the present writer in this chapter presents a brief summary based upon Mr. Thompson's work and gladly acknowledges his indebtedness to that author. It is widely recognized that eternity is not a subject for biblical discussion. One will search in vain for statements such as, "Let us talk or think about eternity," or "Eternity is endless time," or "Timelessness." We may go further and suggest that our study of Olam and An has shown that neither of these terms of itself bears our sense of eternal or even everlasting. How then did these terms and the concepts they represent become so common in theology, Bible study and preaching? It is a common modern practice to contrast time with eternity, a line of thought almost, if not entirely, absent from the sacred writings. Jerome, about 380 AD in his Vulgate Latin version of the Bible, translated Rev.106, T. Mus non erit amplium, Wycliffe, 1,000 years later followed suit with, "Tim shall no more be single," quote, the Avenue 16:11 has, "There shall be time no longer." Though the succeeding chapters of Revelation cover a period of over a millennium with major events occurring on earth, uncritical interpretation has frequently treated Rev.106 as indicating the conclusion of time absolute and the institution or restitution of eternity. Fortunately, the more modern versions employ the alternative idea embraced by the Greek chronos, intervening or waiting time, and therefore hadli shall be no mora, a rendering fully in accord with the rush of events that is presented in the succeeding chapters of Revelation. Still, even today it is not unusual to find scholars talking about time giving place to eternity, a view of which we have found no suggestion in the scriptures. In Old English translations produced before the Norman Conquest, 1066, we may note the absence of Latin terms, even of the word salvation, in the Anglo-Saxon versions of 680-900 AD and even in Wycliffe's of 1380 where health is used. Even Tyndale, 1526, has salvation only in John 4:22, "Salvation cometh of the wis." Similarly for aeonios, the Old English has not eternal, but eis. It seems probable that if the Renaissance with its revival of interest in Greek had preceded the Norman Conquest, our English language, and the NT in particular, would have contained many Greek terms and English equivalents, instead of the great number of Latin terms resulting from the language of Rome predominating in Europe in the centuries preceding 1500 and in the ritual of the Roman Catholic Church even till our own day. With the Renaissance came a great new interest in Greek. Erasmus issued his first Greek NT in 1516. But by the time Jerome's Latin Vulgate dominated Christendom, it was itself an heroic attempt to bring order into the confusion consequent upon the importation of North African versions, largely unchanged since Tertullian, around 200 AD, into contact with the different dialect of Italy and with the Greek manuscripts. For and Jerome found in the old versions, two Latin words, seculum and eternus. From these we have derived, secular and eternal. Seculum is commonly defined as a generation, an age, world, times, a century. Secular things belong to this present time or world, usually as contrasted with spiritual matters. Ancient Roman sports were called secular games. Heredian, about 200 AD, calls those aeonian games. Other examples of secular, meaning centuries, age, or period appear in the decrees of the Council of Trent, 1543-63, and in the works of some early fathers. This term seems never to have meant eternity. In the Vulgate, an is rendered seculum 101 times. Eternum 27. The plural aeons, common in Revelation, Jerome calls seculums, and he uses the phrases from the seculums, for the seculums, before the seculum, the future seculum, this seculum, the consummation of the seculums, the coming seculum, and so on, in a clear and consistent manner. But his use of aeternum is not so readily understood unless we accept the view that in Jerome's time, aeternum did not mean endless infinity. Wycliffe, in working from the Vulgate, puts world for seculum, but for aeternum he has forever. Thus there appear in English two distinctly different words to translate the same Greek term, and some examples of Jerome's use of aeternum will illustrate the problems of discordance that appear to arise. In his Gallican version of the Psalms from the LXX, he usually translates eastern aeona as in aeternum, but where the plural occurs in Psa.61, 4 and 72, 17, he used seculums. Psa.202 in the LXX as from the aeon and till the aeon thou art God. Here Jerome uses seculum, but for the same phrase in Sir 103, 17 he employs aeternum. In Exodus 15:18 and Micah 4:5 he has for aeternum and beyond. Many other examples could be produced to show that for Jerome, aeternum probably did not represent a concept of absolute infinite duration. When Wycliffe consistently used without end to translate aeternum, he seems to have established a precedent in English for attaching to that word and, through it, to olam and the philosophic concept of infinitude. It may be that for periods of known or approximately calculable duration, such as century, lifetime, generation or age, Jerome used seculum, whereas aeternum served for time spans of unhorizoned extension. Not only does thought mold language, language largely conditions thought processes. A few of the many important theological and biblical terms derived from Latin through the Vulgate which have powerfully affected doctrine and preaching may be listed: salvation, perdition, destroy, destruction, damnation, perish, punish, torment, dispensation, priest, propitiation, mediator, redemption, person, reconciliation, ablation, justification, and eternal. Because of the varying degree in which such words differ from the meaning of the corresponding Hebrew and Greek expressions, it behooves the student and teacher to examine carefully the terms he meets with and uses, always endeavoring to make his own statements accord with those of the inspired authors, as theirs may be discovered by concordant contextual research. In this way we may approach more closely to an appreciation of the message of the sacred scriptures. Return to main index page.